Economic Development. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 5011 as a subcommittee of the subcommittee, and with a tap of the gavel, we'll be open. And at this time, Robin Lamont is going to give us an overview of this budget.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you have in front of you House Bill 5011 for discussion. I just wanted to cover a couple of points before I move into the overview. One is you've got a two-sided agenda. The front page shows what we are doing today. The back side is sort of a map of where we think we're going to be going and what we will be hearing on the specific days. After today, we will move into a detailed discussion of the budgets for each of these areas. So today is a very high-level overview. If you have specific questions about specific programs, it probably would help to wait till they're up in front of you. Right now, our goal is to give you sort of a broad overview. The other thing is that even though we can't go into work session because we don't have the rules, what I would like to do is get some conceptual agreement on some of the areas within the budget so we don't have to revisit it when we come back and actually have a work session. We will take official action at the time that we have a work session, but I will be outlining some of the areas where LFO will probably be making recommendations and try to get some feel from the committee as to whether or not those recommendations would be acceptable in work session. So it's a little bit different than I've ever done before, but then things are different all the way around this time. So be prepared on Monday the 17th and Tuesday the 18th to be doing some specific discussion of specific areas within the budget. I have given everyone a copy of a rather thick handout that lays out a bunch of information. I'm not going to go through all of it. Most of it is just for your information. What I will do is walk through the overview beginning on page 4 and urge folks to read through the LFO analysis that starts on page 8 and if there are specific questions, to get back to me. So with that, I'll just give you a brief overview of the department. The Department of Consumer and Business Services is divided into three program areas. One is regulation and enforcement of workplace safety and health, and that includes workers' compensation. The other is financial and insurance regulations, and then there is regulation of building codes and other consumer services. Central Support Services provide support to those program areas, and not listed on this bullet is the are the non-limited accounts that I'll discuss in just a minute. Most expenditures in this department are for non-limited activities. They include workers' comp and Oregon Medical Insurance Pool costs primarily. Workplace safety and health is 15% of the budget. Finance and insurance regulation is 5%. Building codes and consumer services is 4%. And central support is 6%. Workload growth and non-limited payments drive the Department of Consumer and Business Services expenditures. And as you can see from this graphic, most of the growth has been in the non-limited area. And the department will talk to you about why that is happening. DCBS receives revenue from a variety of sources. Again, the department will walk you through some of these specific areas, but the main areas of revenue are workers' compensation, cents per hour, business licenses and fees, insurance premiums, and workers' compensation insurance taxes. The department receives a significant part of its revenue from federal funds, but is authorized by statute to spend those funds as other funds. So we will not have a separate limitation for federal funds. And OMIP claims have now become the major source of non-limited expenditures in the governor's budget. They're 52% of non-limited expenditures. The workers' benefit fund is 46%, and then there are small expenditures in other areas. The significant budget issues that are coming forward in the governor's budget have to do with revenue in the building codes area, in particular a reduction in revenue and a corresponding reduction in staff, and a fee bill and a policy option package to request partial restoration of those staff. And with that, I think we can turn it over to the department unless there are questions.
Okay.
Good morning, and thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee. My name is Tori Streisinger. I'm director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and I'll be presenting the overview of our agency and its budget. And with me here today is Greg Malkasian, the deputy director of our department. As I think you're probably aware, I joined the department a little over 3 weeks ago, and I've been spending a good portion of the past few weeks getting up to speed on the agency's programs and issues. I'll try to answer your questions as best I can, but you will, as Robin mentioned, also be hearing from our division administrators over the next few days, and they will get into their program areas in more detail. And the material that I will be covering is under the Agency Overview tab in your notebook. I'd like to start with the mission of DCBS, which you'll find on page 4. Our mission is to protect and serve Oregon's consumers and workers while supporting a positive business climate in the state. We don't regard these as opposites or alternatives, but rather as complementary, and we've therefore identified three fundamental goals to guide all of our programs as we move forward. You'll see these at the top of page 5, and they are, first, protection of Oregon consumers and workers; second, regulation in a manner that supports a positive business climate; and third, excellent customer service. Each of our programs is tied directly to the agency's mission, and each of our activities is focused on achieving these three goals. I want to come back to these goals in a minute when I discuss our performance measures and our program evaluation process, but I thought it would be useful first to review our major program areas beginning on page 9 of your materials, and I apologize for jumping around a little. We're organized into 5 major divisions and a number of smaller programs. The major divisions are the Workers' Compensation Division, Oregon OSHA, the Building Codes Division, the Insurance Division, and the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. As I mentioned, you will be hearing separate presentations from the administrators of each of these, so I'm just going to touch briefly on their major responsibilities. First, the Workers' Compensation Division, which generally enforces the workers' compensation laws. Its functions include ensuring that coverage is provided by employers, establishing and enforcing rules relating to claims administration, establishing standards for disability ratings, investigating complaints of workers' compensation abuses, offering return-to-work incentives and regulating return-to-work programs, resolving medical treatment disputes, and licensing worker leasing companies. Funding for the Workers' Compensation Division is provided primarily by workers' compensation premium assessments. The next major division is Oregon OSHA, which administers the Oregon Safe Employment Act, and its major functions include enforcing job safety and health laws to ensure safe conditions for Oregon workers, promulgating job safety and health regulations, providing safety and health-related training for employer and employee groups, and providing safety and health consultation services to employers and employees in areas such as compliance with OSHA regulations, hazard assessments, and evaluation of safety programs. And as I think you'll hear later from the division, their goal is that every encounter with the division be a learning experience to promote worker safety. Funding for Oregon OSHA comes mainly from workers' compensation premium assessments and federal funds spent as other funds. The third of our major divisions is the Building Codes Division, which is responsible for administration of statewide building codes for residential and commercial construction. Its major functions include development, adoption, and interpretation of statewide building codes, issuance of permits and inspection of construction in certain parts of the state, primarily rural Oregon, where local jurisdictions do not provide this service, statewide inspection of particular areas, boilers, manufactured housing, and elevators, coordination with local building code officials to increase uniformity in building code application, and certification and licensing of construction inspectors, plumbers, and electricians, and administration of continuing education for these trades. The funding source for Building Codes Division are primarily permits, surcharge, inspections, and license fees. And as you've heard, in the Building Codes area, we do have a reduction package reflecting decreased fee revenue, which would cut $4.8 million and about 31 FTE. And we do also have a partial add-back package, which is tied to our proposed fee bill, House Bill 5059. And the add-back package would restore about $1.58 million of that $4.8 million cut and would also restore about 9.5 FTE, primarily in the area of inspections. The fourth of our major divisions is the Insurance Division, and its major functions include determining the qualifications of insurers seeking to do business in Oregon, ensuring their solvency, reviewing insurance rates and forms for reasonableness and compliance with Oregon law, enforcement of the insurance code, assistance to insureds in resolving complaints against companies and agents, licensing of insurance agents, and serving as a receiver for insurance liquidations and rehabilitations. And funding for the Insurance Division comes primarily from insurance assessments, fees, and charges for services. Our fifth and final major division is the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, which covers a number of areas, including chartering state banks, credit unions, and other financial institutions, assuring the safety of deposited funds, regulation of the sales of securities and commodities under Oregon law, and regulation of a variety of consumer financial transactions to ensure fair treatment. And these include, for example, title loans, pawnbrokers, and pre-need funeral plans. Funding for this division comes mainly from assessments, license fees, and then also charges for services. In addition to these five major program areas, smaller programs within the department include the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, which provides health insurance coverage for Oregonians who are unable to obtain coverage in the private market, the Office of Minority, Women, and Emerging Small Business, which certifies these businesses under state and federal law to provide them with increased contracting opportunities, and two ombudsman programs within the director's office, which provide assistance in the area of workers' compensation. These are the Ombudsman for Injured Workers and the Small Business Ombudsman. We also provide administrative and financial support for the Workers' Compensation Board, although programmatically it is an independent agency reporting to the board chair. And the board chair will be discussing the board services later on during her budget presentation. We have two central support divisions, which you'll hear more about later, the Information Management Division, which provides technology system support, research, and analysis, and the Business Administration Division, which provides accounting, budgeting, purchase, and facility management services. We find that centralization of services in these areas allows us to take advantage of economies of scale and also provides each of the divisions with access to a higher degree of expertise in these specialized areas. Finally, the director's office includes two centralized functions in addition to myself, Mr. Malkasian, and our staff. These are our Office of Personnel Services, which handles our human service needs, and our communications office, which coordinates internal and external communications for the entire department. We are also anticipating that support for the governor's regulatory streamlining initiative will be housed in the director's office, and I'll talk about that initiative a little more in a few minutes. The summary that I've just given you describes the agency as it exists today, but it might also be helpful to touch on its history a little at this point, and you'll find that on page 20 of your materials. The predecessor to this agency was formed in 1987 as the Department of Insurance and Finance. At that time, it included regulation of banking, securities, insurance, workers' compensation, and worker safety, what is now Oregon OSHA. In 1993, the agency was renamed the Department of Consumer and Business Services with the addition of building codes, the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, the Office of Minority Women and Emerging Small Business, and also the Appraiser Certification and Licensing Board. In 1995, the Office of Energy was added, but in 1999, that office again became an independent agency. And in 2001, the Appraiser Certification and Licensing Board became independent once again. But several additional consumer protection programs were added to DCBS, and these programs are among those now administered by our Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. It may seem that this history has resulted in a somewhat disparate group of programs housed in one agency, but in fact there are strong thematic links among them. All of them, of course, fall within our mission of protecting and serving Oregon's consumers and workers while supporting a positive business environment. But in addition, the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities focuses primarily on protecting consumers in their financial affairs, ensuring the soundness of financial institutions. The insurance division then focuses on a specific aspect of financial protection, that provided by insurance. The Oregon Medical Insurance Pool provides insurance to a specific group of consumers. The workers' compensation division assures the availability of a different type of insurance for workers injured on the job. And while workers' compensation focuses on injured workers, Oregon OSHA's job is to prevent worker injuries through assuring safe places to work. And the Building Codes Division also promotes the safety of not only workplaces, but also residences and other structures through enforcement of appropriate building codes. We are not proposing any major changes in agency organization this biennium, but we are aware of a proposal under discussion to move the Building Codes Division to the Bureau of Labor and Industries. With this background as to our organization, I'd like to return briefly to our performance measures and then move on to our business plan and our strategic initiatives. And the performance measures are set out beginning on page 22 of your materials. DCBS contributes to achievement of two of the Oregon benchmarks. Benchmark number 9, which is Oregon's national rank in the cost of doing business, and benchmark number 54, which is the percentage of Oregonians without health insurance. The first of these, relating to the cost of doing business in Oregon, is key to the activities of all of our divisions. The second, relating to the availability of health insurance, is a more direct focus of our insurance division and the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool. In addition to these benchmarks, we've developed a list of 18 departmental performance measures focused on the three mission-related goals which I mentioned earlier. And those goals, again, are protection of Oregon's consumers and workers, regulation in a manner which supports a positive business climate, and excellent customer service. You have the full list of performance measures, but I'd like to just go through some examples. In the area of protection of Oregon consumers and workers, we're measuring the percentage of regulated entities operating in compliance with applicable laws and regulations. We will also measure the number of claims against employers who do not have workers' compensation coverage, the percentage of injured workers who receive timely and accurate benefits, and the increase in employers who voluntarily achieve certain standards in their workplace safety programs. In the area of supporting a positive business climate, we will look at such items as the percent of minor building permits that can be used in multiple jurisdictions, the utilization of employee return to work programs, involvement of stakeholders in our rulemaking processes, and the handling of cases through alternative dispute resolution rather than through formal hearings process. In the area of excellent customer service, we intend to measure satisfaction through a customer survey. We will track the percentage of timelines met for key departmental functions, and we will look at the percentage of customer transactions completed electronically. Each of our division administrators and the Workers' Compensation Board Chair will discuss the performance measures applicability to their specific program areas later on. Our measures have been reviewed by the DAS Performance Measurement Review Committee, which found them appropriate, although the committee did note that we do not have historical data points for some of our measures. This is true at the agency-wide level, unfortunately, since a number of our measures are new. However, we do have historical data available for many of our measures at the divisional level, and this will give us, we feel, a solid basis for comparison purposes. In addition, we felt it was important to set performance measures that are truly representative of the direction in which we want to go, rather than limiting ourselves to measures on which we already had historical data gathered. Next, I'd like to review a few of our key strategic initiatives as set out in our business plan, and this takes you back to page 5 in your materials. The first of these, which I mentioned earlier, is regulatory streamlining. One of the governor's top priorities for the new administration is to enhance the business climate in Oregon, in part by streamlining regulatory processes that pose a burden on economic activity and the creation of jobs. This streamlining initiative is still taking shape, but will involve DCBS as a lead agency. And among the areas which may be addressed in this initiative are more consistent and predictable application of regulations on a statewide basis, a more flexible approach in applying regulatory requirements while maintaining compliance with underlying substantive standards.
Mr. Chairman, just a question.
Welcome. It's so good to see you.
Thank you, Senator.
On several occasions, I've had to call the building codes, and on one occasion, insurance. And while I know that your customer is the businesses in this state, at what point is the consumer your business? And with this being a new area for you, I'm not indicting you at this point, but I'd like to be more consumer friendly. Because when I called on a construction company before, it was like I had the problem as opposed to the agency trying to represent me as a consumer to the business entity, and therefore I ended up with the insurance company not paying an extended amount because of the trouble that they ran into with the house, which was burned in 99 and was finally finished in 2001. And also the contractors. I just don't think that we, and I'm holding me accountable and responsible as well, because probably I should have dealt with this a little earlier. But I just like to see you guys in those areas not only see that businesses are in compliance, but that consumers can feel as if you're going to be a representative on both ends in terms of fairness on both people parts. I don't want to gouge business, but I sure in hell don't want business gouging me. And I didn't feel that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, I can absolutely assure you that the mission of this agency is to protect consumers and workers while supporting a positive business climate, but we regard ourselves as a consumer protection agency. We regard consumers and workers as our clients and customers. And we regulate businesses. We want to do so in a way that is appropriately balanced. But if you have received the impression that we don't regard consumers as our customers and as the people we serve, I apologize for that. Our insurance division does have a sizable staff devoted to addressing consumer complaints, and I always want to hear from you, and I know that our division administrator always wants to hear from you if you feel that service isn't being carried out appropriately.
Well, I do know that the person at the time is no longer with the agency, so I'm hoping that you will improve upon the relationships that I think the agency wants to have with its consumers, as well as the kind of demeanor that one should have in keeping our businesses whole. I think it's a balanced approach, but I as a consumer should never feel as if I'm wrong because businesses have not acted in good faith with me. You know, so if I, who know a little bit about the agency, got this kind of treatment, what about the average consumer who's out there?
Well, thank you, Senator, and I can only say again, if that continues to be a perception, either on your part or the part of your constituents or anyone else who you come in contact with, please do let us know, because our goal is to serve consumers.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
If I can then return to some of the discussion of the regulatory streamlining initiative, and I do want to actually tie that back to your comment, Senator Carter, which is, although the initiative is aimed at reducing the regulatory burden, it's aimed at doing so in a way that does not diminish the underlying substantive standard. We are not talking about cutting back on consumer protection, cutting back on any kind of protection provided by law, but rather addressing how we do it and whether we can accomplish the same substantive goals in a way that creates less of a, say, a paperwork burden or less confusion for those we deal with. And so those elements are really going to be our focus as we work forward on the regulatory streamlining initiative. And the more that we can do to clarify that difference, it's important to us to do that.
Excuse me, can I clarify something?
Yes.
Senator Carter's question sort of raised the issue for me. Particularly in building codes, there's a lot of difficulty because the services are provided by multiple jurisdictions. Does your streamlining initiative envision dealing with those kinds of circumstances, or is it only a state-focused activity, or do you know yet?
Well, that is actually, Mr. Chair, Ms. Lamont, a significant issue that Building Codes is going to be dealing with, because the Building Codes Division does have oversight responsibility, yet Building Codes, as you say, are administered largely at the local level, and local jurisdictions do have their own approaches. And we do have a number of plans that we want to pursue. One of the areas where some change has already taken place due to legislative action last session was the establishment of the Tri-County Building Code Center, which involves coordination between the 27 local jurisdictions that administer building codes in Washington, Clackamas, and Multnomah counties. And one of the goals has been to achieve consistency in application of codes, but also smoothing out the interface with the customer. So, for example, one of the projects underway is to establish a minor label permit program where a permit could be obtained that would be usable across jurisdictions. And, in fact, you'll see in our performance measures, one of our performance measures is the number of those permits obtained that can be usable in multiple jurisdictions. So we want to continue to work on that process. We also want to continue to work on ways to increase uniformity of application. We are publishing, for example, interpretations that can then be obtained online to help achieve that uniformity. Mark Long, who is the new administrator of the Building Codes Division, actually, prior to his taking that position, was the project manager for the first phase of thinking about the regulatory streamlining initiative. So he is very focused on those issues, and I'm sure would be very interested in discussing with you some of what Building Codes has in mind.
Going back to Senator Carter's line of thinking, I had a conversation with Mike Greenfield, I think it was in the third special session. We were talking about the state employee who becomes kind of like the protector of the administrative rule or the ORS and doesn't really deliver service. So it seems to me that through your in-service training, somehow you've got to change the mindset to service of those people. And that's not something easy to do if you've been in government and you've done a thing a certain way and you've been advanced through the ranks over 10, 15 years because you adhere to a particular rule. I would like to see more latitude of those employees to apply common sense and to make things happen and not be roadblocks to reasonable requests from individuals. Do you have a specific way that you think you're going to be able to train down through your staff people that becomes the mindset? Because I don't think we're ever going to get there simply by putting it on paper.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, I can't give you a specific answer today. That is, however, a goal that's been identified through this process, and there are a couple of ways to approach it. One of them is through customer service training in specific areas, how to approach people who, in fact, are coming before you to seek application of rules in a particular way. That, depending on the area, can or cannot be successful. But it is something that, in particular areas where we see those problems, we think is a useful tool in the toolbox. In addition, we do want to look at how the rules are structured and the degree of flexibility built into the rules. There may be a situation where a rule has no flexibility built in, and there, in fact, is very little ability for an individual applying the rule to help in a particular situation. So we want to look at it from both ends, so to speak. And we'd also be very pleased to consider any other suggestions that anyone has for us.
Mm-hmm. Certainly follow up.
I think, you know, you handle your particular end of it, and I look at LCD, CDQ, Division of State Lands, and the overlap of their permitting system, mm-hmm. and the fees, and where you have to have consultation and buy-off of multiple agencies. And we've had businesses come into Oregon, look at this system, and throw up their hands, and they end up in Washington, California, and Idaho. And they're able to get it done in 60 days, 90 days. In Oregon, you could be tied up in this meringue of paper for 2 years. And it costs money, and it's hurting Oregon's ability to provide family-wage jobs. We need to really focus on that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, I know that there are also discussions underway, both primarily involving some of the other agencies, at ways to put together, say, strike forces on a project basis who can assist particular strategic industries to speed up and break through those kinds of roadblocks.
So I'd encourage you to do so.
Yeah.
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the general overview comment, and certainly I'm not holding you responsible for my view of the agency based on the short duration that you've been in charge of it, but similar to Senator Carter's comments, I come from a different position. I was a licensed plumber for over 25 years and regulated by the agency. I never felt that it had, it seemed like it was a bureaucratic maze. It didn't seem to be, in terms of whether you're representing consumers or the workers and the people in the industry, from the other side as someone in the industry, I certainly didn't feel that the division was on my side. And probably of any government agency I've had interface with, I would rank over the 30 years I was involved, probably the worst record of customer service I've seen in terms of mm-hmm. services to the people that were being regulated. I, as a county commissioner, was involved in the regional approach in Multnomah County. And the interplay between the department and the local officials, and it's hard to kind of pin down where the problem is. I think a lot of it is with the attitudes and the maze of the local officials. I think they're, but it's like pulling teeth to get anybody to move anywhere. We're, you know, you're proud of the multiple agency permit process. We authorized multiple, the legislature authorized in Metro, and I was a Metro counselor before the county commission stand. This is going back into the dark ages of the late 80s. We authorized passport licensing that was handled regionally. And it's been almost a decade and a half before we get to the next step of passport permitting. I mean, that's incredibly slow when you figure that you've got one economic region. And, you know, kind of the, that's, I've never been able to really put my finger on it in terms of whether it's the level of detail that we put in the regulations that make it impossible to do flexibility, or whether it's such a diverse decision-making process between the multiple agencies that are involved and a state agency with all different people's views and needs that cause it so make it so difficult to create a change. But it's not, it's certainly not a an agency that I have either a great deal of faith in or a great deal of comfort that change is going to come easily or swiftly. Anyway, that's kind of the overview with, and then from where my perspective is.
I think Corey said a key word, and that is, and it's focused here as well, and that with you being a statewide agency, and so much depends on local governance, that's probably where some of the problems are, and I'm just wondering, in your refocusing your efforts on a statewide building code basis, if there isn't maybe mayors and if it's in the county commission office, wherever it, the local building codes are, that there should be some kind of strategic union of operations where I know you can't go in somebody else's jurisdiction and say, you need to straighten up your act. But how do we say that? How do we, because that's what I'm hearing all of us saying. How do you straighten up your act? Because that's the thing, and it's making the state look real bad here. And yeah, and unfriendly business environment and unfriendly to customers. And that's what I hear going on, because I found out in my house now, 2 years later, the building code guy and the construction and the company were in cahoots together. Now I got to pay for some work that he had signed off on, and the construction company has gone about its business to do the next thing. And I know you're saying that that's a pretty heavy statement, but that's exactly what I'm saying, and I will not retract it, even though it's on record. But that's the kind of thing that I'm hearing. How do these people have a much more friendly environment to business while at the same time protecting the consumer at the same time? I think it can happen, but and maybe as an industrial counselor that I am, it appears to me that maybe people's roles need to be changed, because if you stay in a job for 10 or 15 years, you're going to know everybody, and you're going to be likely to say, oh, that's my friend, I know they do good work, and so you're going to be less likely to say that I should be evaluate this situation as much as I can because I know this person's work. Well, you don't always know that person's work. Something is wrong.
Corey, since we're all kind of venting here,
you're setting us challenges.
Yes, that's right. That's a challenge. And I really appreciate these initiative focuses the governor's brought forward and what you're working on. The last bullet point I think is just extremely important. It seems to reflect what everyone is saying, that agency staff culture and attitudes that emphasize collaboration and facilitation. And I may have shared with you before my daughter's experience as a person who went in and was doing site preparation. This was basically for cell towers a few years ago, who worked in California, Oregon, Idaho, Washington, and British Columbia. And she found it rather amazing that the only state that was probably even close to us on regulation was British Columbia, socialist British Columbia. But when she got there, she found a completely different attitude towards approaching the regulation, and it was, how can we help you, facilitate you to meet the requirements that we have? And she came back, and her comment was, this is the most unfriendly state that there is of all the ones she worked in. And of course, what it does is that everyone bills their additional costs, and as they evaluate, obviously, whether you're going to, wouldn't be the same here with the cell tower, because you need them in order to satisfy your customer. But there are other people who are making decisions, which we hear about almost every day, saying, I'm out of here, I'm going someplace where it's more friendly. Mei Yi's example, when she was talking about economic development a year ago, she talked about their decision that they wanted to site one of their new facilities in Oregon, and ended up in Washington State because, it was 13 days, I believe, to meet the regulations there. It was enabling, facilitating them to meet, their requirements. And here we were talking about 24 to 26 months. Just even at that point, just get through the regulatory and land use planning requirements. So I don't think there's anything more important, this is my personal opinion, to get this economy going than to make this system work. I mean, we've got to offer the protection for the consumer.
Yes.
There must be protection for the workers, but at the same time, it's got to be friendly. My personal experience with occupational health and safety, I felt it was very cooperative, particularly on the friendly end. as far as helping us to know what to do as a farmer who's now moved into the area of being under these kind of regulations, I felt that was very helpful, very beneficial. There were a couple things I bumped into I thought were rather bizarre, and in which, for example, a structure that we had in our shop that was a complete overbuild. I mean, this was by Swedish construction standards. It was clearly marked what the weight lifting capacity of the hoist was. That thing with that frame was capable of supporting probably 30 times what that hoist would lift, and yet we couldn't figure out what to do about it. I'm still probably out of compliance here. I'm admitting this today because I don't know what to do about it. Someone should have been able to say, here, you need to do this and this and this. Can you blueprint how it was just drawn? You can see the structure. What would it be? Those are the kind of things that, you know, you go along very positive, and then you hit something that there is no reason not to facilitate the answer to that. It would be ridiculous for me to take a safe structure, which is buried 6 feet in deep in concrete, and cut that off at ground level with a torch. The biggest risk I would have to any employee would be the day I cut that thing off with a torch. And so, you know, there's just things like that. But we know that there's things that could be done to facilitate. When it comes to major company construction, we know it's big. Yes,
Mr. Chair, you know, after we got into this conversation, I'm looking at this, I'm going to take this page out, and I'm going to copy it, and I'm going to send it to my three county planners and say, yeah, hey, this is what we're trying to do. Get your rear end gear.
Mm-hmm. You know? Good idea. Yes, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair George. For the record, for the committee, I do have a potential conflict of interest as I am a developer, and so I want that on the record. And perhaps I can say that for multiple budgets that are going to be coming through, and we can put that on the record. 3 weeks on the job, welcome. I truly echo what the rest of the committee has said today. I perhaps am a little more pessimistic than even these folks because I work daily in this industry, and I cannot tell you how many times working with this department that I've almost felt as if I'm dealing with an entity that feels as if it's above the community, above the law, if you will. And that's very frustrating, and I think, Chair George, you hit it right on the head. If you want to stimulate Oregon's economy, this is where you start. With that said, I have a question, and perhaps this isn't the place to get an answer, but perhaps your staff could help me with this. As I look through the recommended budget brought before us, almost every one of the divisions has an increase. Can someone in your department help me see where those funds are coming from? Because I've read through the different revenue sources, and some of them I see there's going to be a request for a fee increase, for example, with the certificate of authority. Are other increases coming from reserve funds, or are others coming from federal funds? And this isn't a place here today, but if someone could provide me with that information of where those dollars will be coming from.
We will certainly do that.
Mr. Chair, I would recommend that be something that be raised on a program-by-program basis, because each program has... Most programs have a different funding stream, and so understanding what's happening with each of those funding streams will help with the discussion that we're having about how the expenditures are going.
The reason I raised that point is on page 8 it talks about there's over 500 dedicated fees, assessments, and charges, and I'm very self-conscious, knowing what we just heard about today, of knowing that over the next biennium there could be fee increases coming out, I guess I'm not ready to step up and support fee increases when I'm not sure consumers feel that they're getting the biggest bang.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, mm-hmm. There will be a fee bill in front of the committee that, again, will address any fee increases that will be happening in this agency. So,
well, just to the committee, Robin prepared for us. I think everyone has this, Robin, don't they, in their
yes.
packet? And you can see mine looks just like the questions you were asking. And so I hope each one of you go through, and it doesn't need to look as ugly as mine does, but read this and see what questions pop out to you, because that was the same sort of thing that was coming through. Thanks for the information. Corey, you're doing such a great job, and we're just mean.
You're raising good questions, and, you know, particularly for someone coming in new, it's really important for me to hear these things from you.
Right.
And my sense from listening to the comments, and Senator Carter, you raised a specific issue about the insurance division, but also building codes, and I believe most of the other comments were addressed to building codes.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct? And we do have a new administrator in the building codes division too. And I've heard this message loud and clear from you, that, and it's not a surprise, frankly, that this is an area we need to focus on hard. And I'm not underestimating the difficulty of it, both because of when you're dealing with a long established culture that can sometimes be difficult to change. And when you're dealing with multiple jurisdictions, the problems are particularly difficult sometimes to work with. So I certainly would never say to you this is going to be fixed overnight, but I can promise you that it will receive very serious attention.
Corey, if I could make a suggestion,
one of
the most dramatic changes of attitude that I've ever witnessed since I've been involved in government was what happened in DMV, Department of Motor Vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was a complete cultural change, and we saw people go from what I believe was an adversarial relationship with a consumer to being one of helpfulness, and we immediately started picking up, instead of negative responses about their operation, very positive things. And people were saying they were actually... It wasn't like going to the dentist to go to the DMV.
Uh-huh.
They
uh-huh.
actually enjoyed it, that it was very pleasant,
uh-huh.
and they were helpful. And the folks, that if you made a phone call in and asked a question, that they had the information directed right to it. What it was is literally a change from, here, I'm here to regulate you, to what I'm here to help you.
Mm-hmm.
To meet the
That's
requirements.
That's a great example.
Senator,
too.
Corey
was here during that time.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's a great example. That if that could be transferred over to the building codes, because that's where I got my greatest stomach to the city on it, is in the building codes. So I think that that's an excellent example, looking at that corporate culture that was stuck for years.
And I appreciate that, because I agree. It's a very good example. And we need to look for successes and figure out how to replicate them.
Mm-hmm.
I would ask if, whatever training material they used or whatever, however they approached that, because it was very rapid in the transition. I noticed it almost immediately. And at first I thought, well, they're just being nice because it's me. But then the other thing was is that I noticed that all of a sudden I started asking people, what is your response? Very positive.
Mm-hmm.
So it can occur, and I would certainly look to them to see what training mechanism they use to change that attitude. Yes, Reverend
Sherry, that's a good example, but I think you see that same movement with Stephanie Halleck and DEQ and Lindsay Ball and Department of Fish and Wildlife.
Yes.
I mean, constantly striving. They're constantly in contact with all of us,
yeah.
and that communication is trickling down into the employees, and they're making progress, and that's what I really like there.
You know, Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, I met with Stephanie Halleck yesterday, actually, and she mentioned that as well. And so that had occurred to me as another example, actually, so I'm glad you brought that up. And another one, and Senator George, I hope I'm stating what you said correctly, but Oregon OSHA, we feel, has undergone somewhat of a culture shift.
Sure.
And that's within our own agency. And so I think we have a number of examples that we should be able to draw on.
And we went through a transition. An old friend of mine who has passed on now was George Gardner, who worked under the old Oregon OSHA. And he talked about the transition he saw. He went out when he did an inspection as an OSHA inspector. His was to protect the worker and facilitate getting this bills and stuff and moving as quickly as possible. In other words, get the safety, get production. And he said he witnessed a transition into this authoritarian regulation type mode, which he didn't feel actually yielded the kind of protection that he was trying to get. Because he would work with them in order to figure out what could you do. This was back in the old mill days. In order to provide a safe work environment for the folks that were in, particularly wood products and mills. And so he had seen a transition to a more negative, and I've seen the transition back out of that, which is very, very helpful, very, very good to have that. Because I'm going to tell you, it's just like raising a child. We all react the same way,
mm-hmm.
and that is, if you give an incentive for positive, productive action, you get a lot more than threaten to whip them. And I think it's just that simple. I mean, that's just an old farmer's assumption. Correct. We've been holding you up. I'll let you
Mr. Chairman, colleagues, I cannot be responsible for my other two colleagues. I don't know where they are. But I have to leave at 9:30, and so I want you to know I'm not leaving because of your report. But on the workforce issue, I immediately got a meeting with the governor's office on the issues we raised the other day. And so if you don't mind, at that time I will be excused.
Super. And if I could turn the gavel over to you for a minute?
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Corey. Senator Carter and members of the subcommittee, I actually really appreciate this discussion because, as I say, it's very helpful for me as someone coming in new to hear the perspectives. I actually wanted to switch and talk about a couple of our other strategic initiatives, which I think are related. One of them is the fee structure, which I think Representative Smith mentioned, the large proliferation of fees. And one of our strategic initiatives is to evaluate that revenue structure. We are primarily supported by fees and assessments, which are paid by the industries which the department regulates and serves. And specific fees have been established to support very specific programs, with the result over time being a very large number of different fees and charges. And we certainly agree with the principle of tying specific fees to the support of specific programs, but we also believe, and this is part of making ourselves easier to deal with, in the value of a clear and simple and more understandable fee structure. So we've seen the escalation in the number of fees, which has increased our administrative costs of collecting them and has really resulted in a very complex financial structure for us. So we do plan an initiative to look at streamlining fees and, where applicable, standardizing fee methodology across programs with a goal of customer service and increased flexibility.
Corey, may I make a suggestion, and along with Robin's ears being open for tell me if it's a little too much. I'm wondering if, because the building codes piece is going to create a controversy for you, if you might not do a dog and pony show on that and show them where the cost has increased. I mean, because I think sometimes we as legislators can't see where the cost has been increased, and maybe it will make your job a little easier if you show the complexity of the costing out of something. I just think it would be easier for you to get your budget through here.
Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, I think that's a great idea, and we will take that back and see if we can do that. Our fee bill, when you look at our fee bill, it's frankly appalling. It goes on for pages, and that's because we have such a large number of small fees. And I think we owe it to you to explain how those fees fit together, and that, in fact, something that shows up on a list as a couple of dozen different fees may actually represent one small percentage increase in one program. But because the program is broken out into a large number of fees, it looks very different than actually it is. So we will try to do that, and thanks for the suggestion. I want to just touch very briefly on one other strategic initiative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Quick comment on the fee structure. I think maybe it's because of concern about the agency, the total agency, that a lot of those fees that came in, very specific fees to pay for the cost of service of one very small component of your activities. And the industry, because of maybe a lack of trust, has wanted that to be very specific so that they know they'll be getting service for the dollars that they're playing in. And as you build confidence within the industry, then it's much more likely to be able to streamline the fees because of the trust from the industry that the fees will be going for general purposes, and they'll still get the level of service. But usually it's been a battle to get each fee approved and then tied directly to one specific activity. And so you may be able to, as the agency improves, you might be able to really streamline that fee structure.
Thank you.
I think it may be important to make sure that the committee understands the the complicated governing structure within building codes also, because there are independent boards within the agency that have policy authority that dictate some of these fees also. So just when we get to the fee bill, I think that's a very important piece to raise.
Thank you. Yes.
Senator, sorry about that. We had another meeting. Speaking of which, there should be one more. I believe the Construction Contractors Board ought to be under the capable hands of DCBS. Good morning.
Good morning, Senator. No comments.
I understand. I understand.
Well, this actually is probably a good lead-in then to the final program initiative I wanted to discuss, and I almost hate to bring this one up at this point, but it's program review and evaluation. We want to establish as a principle for our department that no regulatory program should continue over time without a periodic evaluation of whether it remains necessary and appropriate. And with that in mind, we are working on a model and a process for evaluating the status of DCBS programs so that we can make strategic decisions and recommendations to the legislature that will consist of program evaluation, including the analysis of costs and benefits, identification of alternate means to achieve the desired ends, testing the resulting assessments with stakeholders, and then and other key users of the programs, and then ultimately making a decision or a recommendation to you. And implementing change. So you will be hearing more from us about that, and obviously I've already gotten good suggestions of where some of that program evaluation needs to focus. I'll be talking in a few minutes about one other strategic initiative, and that's e-government, which ties to the regulatory streamlining piece as well. I do want to just spend a couple of minutes talking about cost controls and interagency coordination. Now, we've already talked about some of that, but if you look at page 14 of your materials, you'll see some additional discussion. And in the area of cost control and cost reduction, because we are fee-supported, and as you pointed out, Representative Hansen, because fees are tied fairly specifically to individual programs, we have a very direct revenue connection to our stakeholders. The stakeholders' fees directly govern the size of program that we can deliver. And we do use a variety of advisory groups as well as the six boards within the Building Codes Division to provide input, feedback, and sometimes decision-making on our fee structures. Our program evaluation, based on the amount of revenue that we receive, has led in recent years to significant cuts in both the Workers' Compensation Division and Oregon OSHA. And in the Workers' Compensation Division, staff reductions resulted from reduced caseload, which in turn were the outgrowth of workers' compensation system reforms. So the system reforms accomplished what they were intended to. In Oregon OSHA, the division prioritized its services and cut staff so that we could hold down workers' compensation premium assessments paid by employers. And you'll be hearing a little more about the workers' compensation system and those premium assessments a little later from Mr. Malkasian. We are also, in response to direction from the Ways and Means Committee last biennium, we have decreased program activity and cut costs in the area of pawnbroker regulation. This biennium, we are also recommending cuts in the area of building codes to reduce costs in reflection of the decreased revenues. We have grown in size and complexity over the years. We have successfully worked to maintain central support and other administrative services at a constant level relative to department growth, so a constant percentage. And we will be having a presentation on our central support services later on in next week, I believe. Over time, we have also reduced FTE counts or kept them essentially flat, and each of our administrators will be discussing their FTE counts with you as they go through their individual presentations. I'd like to talk briefly about our coordination with other public agencies and organizations. Our goals are to avoid duplication, minimize costs.
Wait a second. Let me try one thing. When you get to that point, whoever does, last session we made some cuts in rehabilitation for injured workers, and I would be interested in knowing how many fewer people we are working with and how all of that played out.
We'll be sure to cover that.
Thanks.
We have discussed interagency coordination and some of the challenges in interagency coordination a little already this morning in the building codes area where we do work with so many local jurisdictions. We do feel that the Tri-County program has been a very useful effort, and we do intend to continue to work on that issue. We do, in other areas, also strive to coordinate with other agencies to control costs, reduce duplication of effort, and improve efficiency. I can just give you a few examples. We license worker leasing companies through our workers' compensation division, but because non-compliant companies in that area often raise concerns that cut across agency lines, we also chair a work group that includes representatives from the Employment Department, Bureau of Labor and Industries, Department of Revenue, and the IRS, to coordinate oversight of individual companies with compliance issues. Many of those in the construction trades, and this gets your issue, Senator Dukes, may be licensed by both the Construction Contractors Board and the Building Codes Division. We do have a bill in this session, Senate Bill 198, to allow our Building Codes Division to revoke, deny, or suspend a license whenever the Construction Contractors Board has taken similar action, so that we don't have a situation where a license has been pulled by one agency but a valid license still exists from another. The Workers' Compensation Division is also working with the Construction Contractors Board to coordinate the definition of casual laborers so that contractors don't face contradictory expectations about what classes of workers, construction workers, landscape workers, are subject to workers' compensation requirements. So,
so if we just put them all in the same agency so that the building codes... the folks were all in the same agency, we wouldn't have coordination wouldn't be so difficult.
But at least we are attempting coordination.
Yes, and I appreciate everything that you're doing.
In electronic age, that should be possible. Yes, Professor Hanson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. The question would be which agency?
Yeah.
That's true. I personally would prefer this one, but yes, that's true. As long as we stick them someplace, I'm happy.
Last biennium, you gave us the regulation of pre-need funeral services, and we coordinate with the Mortuary and Cemetery Board over the regulation of the direct providers of these services, since the direct regulation is, of course, responsibility of that board.
Senator Morris, and then we'll
Mr. President, Mr. Chairman, thank you. You skipped over the issue of mold and the dilemma that's causing and getting licensed, inability to get bonds. Can you shed any more light on things that you might be doing proactively? I know that there's a bill in the legislature that will be trying to address this mold issue.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, I have to apologize. That issue is actually not one that has crossed my desk yet, and we will make sure to get you an answer on it later in our series of presentations, but I apologize. I don't have that information right now. There are some other examples of interagency coordination that are set out in our materials. Unless you have questions, I don't think I need to go through the entire list of examples. I do want to, though, spend a few minutes talking about our use of technology and some of our technology initiatives, because we really regard these as critical to accomplishing our substantive goals. And you'll find the discussion starting on page 7 of your materials. We do have a major focus on e-government, and we use the Internet extensively to deliver information, products, and services to businesses, employees, and citizens, and we expect our activities in this area to increase in the coming biennium. For example, we are working on a directory of permits and licenses, online directory, which will allow interested persons to look up various license requirements, download applications, and eventually apply online for the various licenses and permits that we issue. We currently offer online application and renewal for mortgage lender licenses. This was a pilot project for us, and we hope to expand it soon to other areas. And through the regulatory streamlining initiative, we also hope to expand that online permit directory statewide so that there would be a single source where people could find out about permits that are issued by a variety of state agencies And if we can get there, we would hope at some point to have at least some local permitting requirements and information hooked in as well. We provide email notification of departmental activities and actions. We have an online category, online catalog of agency reports and research. We have electronic ordering of health and safety information from Oregon OSHA, the electronic bulletin boards, and some online training opportunities. We are looking to expand our use of electronic data interchange, or EDI. For example, the Workers' Compensation Division is working to establish electronic data interchange links between insurance carriers and the division to automate the exchange of information. And during this biennium, we expect to expand the use of EDI opportunities for workers' compensation proof of coverage, first reports of injury, and possibly subsequent reports as well. We are working with the Department of Administrative Services to develop online payment systems for our licensing programs, with two pilot projects scheduled to begin later this year. In addition,
I had an opportunity the other day to ask a question about actual collections and this sort of fee collections over mm-hmm. You use electronic commerce. One of the things that was suggested, and this said a lot of businesses do it, and they believe the person was informing me about it, believe the government could do it, and that is you have banks who will actually manage that operation for you. Have you guys looked into that? Is that possible for government to do it?
The issue of electronic payment is being handled on a centralized statewide basis by IRMD, the Information Resource Management Division within DAS. And I know that they're looking hard at a number of those options. They have put in place the first, on a pilot basis, electronic payment project, starting, I believe, with the Secretary of State and the Marine Board. We are next in line for a couple of our projects. Mm-hmm. But which of the options they are using, and there are a number of options available, I couldn't tell you at this point. And we would like to move as fast as we can in that direction, consistent with appropriate security requirements, of course, which I know they're concerned about. In addition to e-government, that is, use of technology to interface with our customers, we do use technology extensively internally, for example, an extensive intranet to provide policies and other information to our employees. And we have quite a bit more information about our technology initiative laid out in the written materials. We have been asked to identify for you budget-related policy legislation, which we're proposing. Our legislative proposals are primarily minor and housekeeping measures without budgetary implications, although I did mention Senate Bill 248, which will put into statute the reduced scope of the pawnbroker regulation program. Which will move to, rather than annual field audits, have those be every other year, and the alternate year being a paper in-office audit. Finally, I would like to discuss our affirmative action report, which begins at page 18 of our materials. In summary, we exceed parity for women employees in most areas, but we do still have considerable work to do with respect to persons of color and those with disabilities. Our materials discuss the past 2 years. I'd like to mention some 10-year trends as well. In the categories representing the largest number of our employees, professionals, technical, and office and clerical workers, the percentage of people of color in our workforce has remained essentially flat over that 10-year period in the 6 to 7% range. We have seen a significant increase in the category of officials and administrators, from 3% people of color in 1993 to 8% in 2001 and 2002, but we obviously need to continue and increase our efforts in this area. We have developed a recruitment outreach council to continue and encourage outreach activities for division administrators and managers and our Office of Personnel Services. We're working on building stronger relationships with diverse communities. We are working hard to develop an organizational culture that supports diversity, and we will continue to focus in this area. I do also want to mention that we have a significant outreach effort to citizens from diverse cultural backgrounds. Most of our materials are available in Spanish, and through our multicultural communications program, we have an active outreach to the Vietnamese, Russian, and Native American communities as well. And I'll be happy to respond.
Senator Dukes?
Yeah, and don't take any of this personally. I think I've just been here too long, and I've listened to the same presentation, and not just from your agency. Every agency's presentation on affirmative action looks the same. Actually, you're doing a few more things than most agencies are doing. But they all look the same. They all say, we're not doing good enough, but we're going to try harder. And they've been saying that for years. Yeah, at least 10 years that I know of. And so I'm just here to encourage you to do even more. Maybe job shadowing, maybe mentoring, some things that are not traditional to state government that get us out there more, because I'm tired of the same report. And for the most part, what people don't say, and I have no idea what your numbers are, is that we have more women, then that usually means we have more clerical positions, and so therefore we have more women. So it's, in terms of what we're trying to get to, which is equal access, and representative numbers from around the state, I'm just saying, please try harder, and please try some sort of non-traditional kinds of things, so that next session we don't sit here and listen to we're under the numbers, but we're trying. Thank you. Don't take any of that.
No, Mr. Chair, Senator Dix, that's a very legitimate comment. I will say that with respect to representation of women, we're actually pleased that we show very substantial numbers of women in the agency at all levels.
Yes, I was going to say, you're a great example.
But I know it is all too easy for agencies to come in time after time and say, we'll try harder. And
I was starting to think there was a boilerplate out there somewhere when it came to affirmative action, and we just stuck it in every agency's presentation.
Point noted.
Thank you.
Corey, can you, or would it be possible, and I know it may not be possible to get absolute detail, but what this whole program of affirmative action would cost the agency? Also, how would you handle a person that you might solicit to become an employee who cannot speak English?
We will get you information on both of those. I will say we actually have a program focused on people who are not proficient English speakers because of our customer base.
Mm-hmm.
So the multicultural communications program, we actually recruit people for whom English is not necessarily their first or primary language.
Right.
But the issue of someone who cannot themselves communicate well in English, we'll have to get back to you on.
Okay.
Any other questions I can answer before we turn to the DAS presentation?
Welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, and members of the subcommittee. This is Satish Upadhyaya with the Department of Administrative Services. And today I'm presenting to you the Governor's budget for the Department of Consumer and Business Services for the 2003-2005 biennium. You should have a copy of my presentation documents in front of you. And if you turn to page 2, the government budget consists of $639.1 million total funds. This is a 26.2% increase over the 2001-2003 legislatively approved budget for the fifth special session. This includes $182.9 million of limited other funds. The limited other funds are the agency's operating budget. And this is a 5.9% increase. The budget also has $456.2 million of non-limited other funds. So this is a 36.7% increase from 0103. This significant increase in non-limited other funds is almost entirely due to increased referrals, enrollments, and claims in the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool program. As Corey mentioned earlier, this program provides coverage to those who are unable to obtain health care coverage on their own. And like the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool caseload, in 1999-2001, there were 6,500 enrollees. It is projected that this number is going to increase to 14,000 at the end of the 2003-2005 biennium. And you will be hearing more about this from the agency during the program presentations. If you will turn to page 3, the pie chart there shows the two fund types that make up the agency's budget. You will notice that 71% of the agency budget consists of non-limited other funds. 53% of the non-limited other funds is for the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool payment of claims for parties covered under its insurance plans. And 46% of the non-limited funds are for expenditures from the Workers' Benefit Fund. The workers' benefit fund is used primarily for workers' compensation special payments and return to work incentives. And Greg will be talking more about this in a few minutes. We'll turn to page 4. Again, the governor's budget is a 5.9% increase for agency operations. The only major change approved by the 2002 first to fifth special session consists of the employee compensation adjustments, consisting of a little over $6 million other funds, and this was for all state agencies. Now, the major programs and what is covered in the governor's budget. The governor's budget continues all existing programs. There's a reduction of 21 positions in the building codes division due to revenue shortfall. And the budget is dependent on a fee increase. There will be a fee bill before you. There are fee increases proposed for the building codes division, the insurance division, and the department of and the division of finance and corporate securities for the pawnbroker program. Now, if you turn to page 5, the pie chart there shows the various divisions, programs within the department. Again, you will notice that the Workers' Benefit Fund and the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool Claims Program consist of over 70% of the budget. I'm going to page 6. This shows the various budget categories. Special payments make up 69.7% of the budget. Personal services is 23%, services and supplies 7.5%, and capital outlay is 0.1%. Now I'm on page 7 now. Let me now tell you how the governor's budget was developed. The starting point was the 2001-2003 legislatively approved budget. This consists of $472.4 million of total funds. There were base budget adjustments consisting of a roll-up of 2001-2003 position actions and compensation changes. This totals to $18.3 million total funds. And there's a base non-limited adjustment of $123.1 million non-limited other funds. This is due to increased referrals, enrollment, and claims in the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool Program. Now, we also have a number of essential packages. Package 010 provides funding for standard inflationary increases for temporary appointments, overtime, and shift differentials. And it also provides adjustments for vacancy savings. This package has a negative $240,247 total funds. And package 030 provides the standard inflationary increases for services and supplies and capital outlay, and it provides adjustments for changes in the state government service charges. We turn to page 8. We have a number of policy packages. The first package, package 070, is a revenue reduction package, and this is for the building codes division. There's a reduction of $4.8 million other funds and elimination of 31.08 full-time equivalent positions.
Mr. Chair?
Mm-hmm.
Back here on page 4, it says we're reducing 21 positions in building codes. And now we're, where did it just go? 31.08 full-time equivalent positions.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, we are restoring, if you just looked at to package 191, we are partially restoring some of the positions in package 191.
And to get us down to the 21?
21. And also we have an issue of positions versus full-time equivalent positions, so there's a slight difference because of that.
Okay. And could somebody, when we get to that, to the work session, let me know if we were to reduce or eliminate the inflation and salary increases, if we could buy back any, I mean even one of those building codes positions.
Yes, we'll let you know.
Thank you.
So package 070 is a revenue reduction, and package 081 is the action by the third special session. This is elimination of 3% cost of living increases for employees at salary range 38 and higher. This also you see for all state agencies. Package 090 is a reduction in the capital outlay budget of the department's budget during the governor's budget process. There was a reduction of $844,643 other funds for expandable properties based on the agency's 15-month expenditure pattern. And package 191 is building codes restoration. This is the package that partially restores the positions that got reduced in package 070. And this package would increase other funds expenditure limitation by $1.6 million other funds and restores 9.58 full-time equivalent positions. And this package is based on legislative approval of the fees that were administratively established or increased during 2001-2003. So if you do not approve the fee bill, then this package would not be there. If we turn to the last page, and that is page 9, there is a fee bill, that's House Bill 5059, which you will be listening to, and this provides for fee increases for the Building Codes Division, Insurance Division, and the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities Fund Broker Program. To conclude, now the governor's budget basically maintains, continues all programs with a reduction in the Building Codes Division budget because of revenue shortfall.
Questions?
Chairman, back on page 7, lists $2.3 million increase for adjustments and changes in state government service charges. What would those be?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morse, this consists of two elements. One is the standard $1.7 million. $1.67 million is for cost of goods and services increases. This is the standard inflationary increases on services and supplies. There is a 3.5% inflation factor for services and supplies and capital outlay. And we have and there are certain other higher amounts of inflation. For example, Attorney General was allowed 12.4% inflation for all state agencies. So that includes that. That consists of the cost of goods and services inflation. There's also a state government services charge increase. Now, the Department of Administrative Services comes with a price list, and there are charges for services like the Department of Administrative Services charges, the Secretary of State charges. So it's based on that. And if you'd like a breakdown, we'll be glad to provide that for you by item.
Mr. Chair, Robert? Members of the committee, the state government service charge issue is being dealt with as we sit here. The Department of Administrative Services is being heard in one committee. The Department of Justice is being heard in another. When the statewide decision is made on what those budgets look like, the state government service charge will be adjusted. At the direction of the co-chairs, all of the inflation adjustment is coming out. So the 3.5% that was added for services and supplies for all state agencies is going to be eliminated.
Thank you. You're getting at the point that I was interested in.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Greg Malkagian. As Craig indicated earlier, I'm the Deputy Director of DCBS. And today I'll be covering some of the things under the Workers' Compensation System tab of your notebook, which just follows what Satish was reviewing. And the purpose of this is to kind of give an overview of how the system is performing, and then also hope to get information to you at a very high level of how we use the budget. And then we'll cut down a little deeper into each of the programs in subsequent days of our presentation. And John Schiltz will be talking about the Workers' Compensation Division aspect of contributing to the system. Maureen Bach will be talking about the board. And Pete DeLuca will be talking about Oregon OSHA. But this system overall for the agency is very significant. It represents two-thirds of the funding of our program. And as Satish had mentioned earlier, the benefits that flow through to Oregonians and both injured workers and employers represent 46% of the non-limited budget. So I hope to cover a little of the background today, the assessments that support the system so that there's an understanding of that, and then the funds and their uses generally, and then each of those division administrators will get down to a little deeper level as they come up to present to you their programs. Bottom line, the purpose of the system, the workers' compensation system, is to have a no-fault system that's based on the principle of exclusive remedy. And the idea there is that injured workers receive benefits and the employers are protected from liability suits. So that's why it's a no-fault system. And the outcomes, or what is provided through the systems, are those medical and disability benefits to the injured workers. The system also provides for efforts towards reducing injuries in the first place, and then also incentives to both the injured workers and the employers to return to work early, and that's a savings to the system overall. It covers 1.6 million workers and 84,000 employers in Oregon. It's a three-way system. And the reason why Oregon is called a three-way system is because it includes private insurers, where you can get your workers' compensation insurance. It also has a state fund, the State Accident Insurance Fund. You'll hear probably comments about SAFE throughout this proceeding. And then self-insured employers and self-insured employer groups. So that's why we have a three-way system, three ways to get the insurance coverage for those benefits that I was talking about. The goals of the system from a regulatory perspective is to ensure balance in the system. And on page one, there's a list of several of the stakeholders. And one of the key groups is the Management Labor Advisory Committee. And they really serve as a consideration element representing the key players in the system, and that key element of looking at potential policy changes that affect the system, achieve the balance that I talked about earlier before they come to the legislature for significant policy changes. The system has a direct link to benchmark number 9, which is on page 2 of the presentation materials, which is the Oregon's rank in the cost of doing business. And you'll be hearing more about this later from the divisions, but this has been a significant success, you know, bottom line, what we in Oregon are getting for the money of the program. I'll give a little bit of the background and the history, which involves going way back to 1990 and the Mahonia Hall discussions, where agreements were forged by then the first Management Labor Advisory Committee that led to 1990 reforms in the system to overall impact the cost of the system. And then there were other outgrowths in 1995 and 1999, fine-tuning the system. And the ultimate payoff of those changes are that claim rates are down by 40% when we look at the period 1987 to 2001. And that graph is shown on page 3. You can see the steady decline on page 3. And I'll be bumping back and forth here. But at the same time, 1987 to 2003, benefits have increased by 347%. Now, we were one of the lowest benefits paid states in the union, and now we've moved to the middle of the range. So overall, during generally this period, we've moved from the sixth most expensive state for workers' compensation insurance to the 35th most expensive state. And 35 out of 50, obviously, saying most expensive can be confusing, because what it really means is that we're one of the lower cost states now for workers' compensation. That basically summarizes the what we've got from the system. Now I'd like to talk a little bit about the who pays and how we use the budget. And that we'll be talking about this a lot from page 4 and then on. But I'll be talking about insurance premiums, bottom line, how they factor in into providing the benefits, obviously, and then the premium assessment, It was tacked on to the insurance premium for paying the cost of operating the system, and then the cents per hour assessment, which really is the money that comes in to flow through for additional benefits to injured workers and employers. One of the key things about insurance premium, which is the bottom line basis for covering the disability benefits and medical benefits to injured workers, is that since 1990 there's been a drop or a reduction of 57.4%, which for insurance premium means that there's been a $7.5 billion savings over this period to Oregon employers. The graph on page 4 depicts that negative drop in pure premium, and it's important to understand that that's a cumulative drop over the years since 1990 because of the reforms. The premium assessment rate is the assessment added to the insurance premium that's remitted to insurers that's ultimately is paid by them to DCBS to fund the program operating costs. And as you can see from the table on page 5, that premium assessment rate in the last few years has been fairly stable. The most recent adjustment to the 8% was based upon an anticipated recessionary period. And Corey mentioned earlier in her testimony how we made specific adjustments, and Senator Dukes commented about some of those adjustments in the last session that resulted in keeping that assessment rate down at 8.0% rather than potentially 9.1%. We anticipate, based on early information, that the rate may be lower next year. The premium assessment revenue is the major component of the funds the operating system or the agency itself. And there's a graph on page 7 that depicts that. And you can see that $96.3 million is the major hunk of the revenue that comes in to support the system there. So we've talked about the aspect of the money that people pay to insurers as premiums to cover the cost of the medical and disability payments to workers. And we talked about how the premium assessment, which is added on to that premium paid, comes into DCBS for us to be able to cover the cost of the systems. Now let's talk a little bit about that portion of the system that funds the other benefits to injured workers and employers. I'm just going to touch on this because John Schiltz is going to go into much more detail in the next presentation. He'll be following me on Monday.
Senator Morris?
Excuse me. This really isn't so much a fiscal question as what is the reason behind the assessment rate dropping to 6.7 in your budget? I mean, that's good news. I was just wondering what's the driver for that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morse, the drop is a factor of a number of things. One factor is the premium base. And as you probably noticed, premiums are going up in a lot of the lines of insurance. And workers' comp insurance is one of those lines where there is some increase there as well. The also is an econometric aspect of how we look at building the model that determines a premium assessment rate, and that is the base itself. And as we move out of a recessionary period, we should have more employees, which means higher base itself from that as well. And then the other aspect is the cost of the system itself. And that's how it's factored, and some of those At this point, our analysis is showing that we're probably going to see a reduction.
Thank you.
Thanks for the question.
Chair, are all the people that deal with safe claims within your agency?
Oh, Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, no. Actually, SAFE is an independent insurance company that's a quasi-state agency. None of those claims examiners are in our agency. They are equivalent to an insurance company that we regulate.
You regulate them?
Yes. Thank you. So I'll go into that aspect of the worker benefit fund, the money that flows in to provide additional benefits. And on page 6, we have an outline of the changes in what is called the cents per hour. And that's a money that is paid half by employees and half by employers. And the current rate is 3.6 cents per hour, and it's the major component of the worker benefit fund. And the worker benefit fund graph for revenue sources is shown on page 9 of your presentation materials. And you can see that it is the biggest source of revenue. And John Schiltz will be going into much more detail on what these benefits provide, but I just want to touch on the fact that these are things that go out to benefit the injured workers and employers. They include the retroactive program, and that provides insurer reimbursements for increased benefits to claimants injured when benefits were lower. So obviously, if a injured worker submitted a claim in 1936 and has a long-term disability and is continuing to get disability payments, those payments will increase over time, and this fund provides the increased element to the initial benefits that were provided the insurer. The Reemployment Assistance Program that John will be visiting with you about provides incentives to employers to hire injured workers. And the key there, obviously, is to get workers back into the workforce to reduce the cost overall to the system. And we also have a program that encourages early return to work by injured workers on a modified work schedule, and we provide incentives for that to employers to encourage that early return to work. There's also an element that you may hear about that there's a payment to the Center for Research on Occupational and Environmental Toxicology, and that is more fondly referred to as CROET, and that money flows both partially from the premium assessment and the workers' benefit fund to go to research that ultimately should benefit in occupational illness and injuries. John, obviously, as I said, will be going more into these presentations on Monday, and as well as the elements of safety from Pete DeLuca and Maureen Bach from the board. But we wanted to give you the overall view of the system before we dig down a little deeper into the detail.
So I believe that concludes our planned presentation for today, unless you have additional questions for any of us.
Oh, okay. All right. Rob just reminded me that I had questions on the budget notes and said that if we had time, we could discuss those. And everyone will look at the, yeah, right. Everybody has it. This page right here.
Page on.
This is the piece that Robin handed out to us. And it describes the budget notes.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, Greg Malkasian, each of the division administrators will have additional information here. If I could give you just kind of a summary of the budget notes, which are on page 3 of your presentation?
It's actually page 1.
Page 1?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. Okay. That's right. I have my notes on my page 3. each of the division administrators, if you want additional information, we can get that from them. But I'll give you just kind of a little overview of them. The first budget note is about DCBS assisting MLAC to evaluate statutory funding for COET. And the question there was, is it appropriate for that one half of the funds to come from the worker benefit fund and one half of the funds to come from the premium assessment? The committee, MLAC committee, did review that. Oh, wait. Am I on the wrong one? I'm on number 2. I'm sorry. Okay. I'm sorry.
I'm assuming we already discussed technology, but that's all right.
Okay. I'm on number 2. I'm sorry. And NMIC did consider that, and they recommended the status quo. Let me jump back to number one, because we did present on January 8th to the Joint Legislative Committee on Information Technology our response to that, and we really touched on the three main areas that Corey did talk about earlier, which were electronic data interchange, electronic government, and those aspects of our initiatives to support that, as well as some process improvement areas. The third one is...
Senator Dukes?
On the second one, did MLAC produce a piece of paper that said why they made that recommendation?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, could I defer to John Schiltz on that, perhaps either in his presentation or right now?
Let me just say this. Okay. If they did, could we have it?
Yes, ma'am.
If they didn't, there's not much I can do about that.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think... actually,
John can answer that.
Okay, great.
Excuse me, I'm John Schiltz, the administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division. Chair George, Senator Dukes, the answer to your question is no, they did not commit that to writing.
How long did they take discussing this?
Chair George, Senator Dukes, I don't recall the amount of time that was spent on it. There were a couple of meetings devoted where there was discussion about CROET and with CROET as well, as they provided their annual report I believe it was the last meeting of the Management Labor Advisory Committee, but in terms of the amount of time that was spent, I don't recall. I could do some research on that and get back to the committee with that information.
This is just a big issue last session, Mr. Mm-hmm. Chair, and trying to shift funds and determine how important this whole thing was. And
let me just springboard from that. I mean, was it consensus then that we did have appropriate level of funding?
Chair George, my understanding was it was not a question of appropriate funding, but where the funding should come from, either the out of the premium assessment mm-hmm. or from the cents per hour assessment. The way it's done currently is that half of it is from the premium assessment account and the other half comes from the worker benefit fund. And the question was whether or not that was appropriate or whether it should be all coming from the worker benefit fund. And MLAC did, as I mentioned earlier, did consider the question and they made no recommendations for changes.
Does that mean that they didn't give us a response at all?
Chair George, Senator Dukes, the committee basically provided no recommendation to us.
So there was no positive, we think it ought to stay the way it is, recommendation? There just wasn't a recommendation?
Chair George, Senator Dukes, there wasn't any direct recommendation made to us about it.
Okay.
Representative Hanson?
Mr. Chair, that sounds like we don't like it, but we don't know how to fix it recommendation.
Chair George, Representative Hanson, my observation of the committee, there were committee members who gave very positive endorsements about the Center for Research Occupational Environmental Toxicology. There were two or three members that spoke up very positively about what they were doing. But again, they made no specific recommendation for a change.
Sure, just simply on the funding issue. Not the quality of the work issue is what I was saying. We don't like it, or we don't like it but don't know how to fix it. We applied to the funding, not the quality.
Mr. Chair, members, the third Regit note deals with the report itself. So
that's what I was going to ask. You go to number three.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The third budget note is essentially where DCBS was directed to ensure that CROAT submits their annual report to the Management Labor Advisory Committee, providing data about what sorts of services they are providing to Oregon employers and what the impacts are of their activities on workplace safety and health. And again, they have done that on an annual basis since the last session. And the Management Labor Advisory Committee did indicate their satisfaction with the report and the information.
Have we received that report?
I have copies of their annual report. Excuse me, Mr. Chair. I have copies of their annual report with me today, and I'd be glad to provide those to the committee.
I think that would be helpful. That was one of my primary questions. The number three.
Thank you, John. For the record, Greg Malkasian again. And back to that budget note number two, we will get you a letter to confirm the discussions.
Oh, Mr. Chair, mm-hmm. You don't need to produce a letter. In my opinion, MLAC seems very helpful. And other times, they don't seem very helpful. And this is an issue I can understand they might have some difficulty coming to agreement on, but it was important to me that they chose not to say anything as opposed to making some positive statements. So you don't need to do a letter. You got enough.
Thank you very much. I'll continue with the budget note number four on page two of Robin's material. And this dealt with an issue that Corey had discussed earlier, which was the reduction of the pawnbroker program in order to operate that program at a level, at a minimum level, and lower the potential fees associated with it. And that was reported to the emergency board, and the report was accepted. On number five, that was a building codes division or presentation to provide information on the examination of program activity levels, some of the fee revenue questions, and they were a lot related to those fees that were administratively increased that Satish related to earlier, that you will also be considering during the fee bill discussions or deliberations later on next week. And we provided a full report to the committee. The request is that the committee accept the report, and they did accept that report as well. It will be revisited again. The sixth budget note was a response that many agencies had this budget note in their budgets, and that actually was presented by the Information Resources Management Division of the Department of Administrative Services, and they discussed the plans that they had for moving to centralization, and we are working very closely with DAS IRMD. Corey sits on the Information Technology Executive Committee, and our Information Management Division Administrator, Dan Adelman, sits on the Chief Information Officer Council that supports activities of that division. So we feel that we really are in line with an enterprise approach to looking at information systems. And so DAS had completed the report on that one.
That appears that that's actually going to save money, streamline your operation, provide a better website. Any opinion about that?
Oh boy.
DAS is listening. It's okay.
Yeah, well, Chair George, we're in the early phases, and part of that is going to be analysis and justification, obviously. There is going to be some tremendous benefits for agencies, I believe, an opinion, that have low levels of technology competency at this time or support. And those agencies that are pretty sophisticated may find that they have additional costs for transition. It's a hardware and software and systems utilization issue. Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
And the seventh budget note was asking us to come back and identify the need for $336,000 that was unscheduled related to some security of our systems. We went back to the committee and presented our plan, and it was a bottom line issue of hardware and software to improve system security, as well as contracting with TruSecure, which is a company that reviews security and also can give a kind of a United Laboratories approval of systems to ensure that our system is secure. And they are Joint Legislative Committee on Information Management Technology approved rescheduling this money, and TruSecure and our staff are currently working at attaining a certification for our system to assure that it is secure, and we're continuing to move forward on that initiative.
Have you folks had many assaults on the system to attempt to penetrate it? I see head nodding yes.
Yeah. Chair George, we have, and we could get you some of the information on that, but we're real pleased that we have TruSecure working with us to ensure that we receive notification of those attempts rather than actual successful assaults. So that concludes the review of the budget notes. If that's satisfactory, we won't ask the division administrators to go into more depth unless you have a specific question.
Very good. Senator Morris.
Well, I'm ready to move into a new territory.
Are you? That's fine. Let's do it. Because right now, I think everyone is completed. We can just take a few minutes to talk about any questions you have.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Would it be possible for you to provide the committee an age analysis of your accounts receivable?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, we'll provide an aging analysis of our accounts receivable.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, anything further to come before the committee? With that, we'll be adjourned.
Thank you.